The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Money for the Rest of Us, a personal finance show on money, how it works, how to invest it, and how to live without worrying about it. I'm your host, David Stein. Today, it's episode 30. It's titled, Are You Sure You're Diversified? Before I get into the topic, I wanted to revisit briefly last episode, episode 29. You may or may not have noticed that I went a little Planet Money on you and I added some music interludes. My thought process on that was music sometime when added to a podcast can, or to a show, can sort of reset the brain a little bit. However, I got some pretty pointed feedback from some listeners that just weren't too keen on it. Comments such as cheesy, distracting, decoration, etc. Although I got some comments that were positive. So if you could, if you notice the music, if you feel strongly that you don't like it or you think it was a great addition, just email me, jd@jdavidstein.com. This episode, no music. And my thought is probably not to do music in future episodes, unless there's an overwhelming desire for some type of music to play at times in the background just to reset the brain. But on to today's topic. I got an email from Adam R. this past week, and let me quote briefly from it. He says, in listening to your show, one question that has stuck out to me is how one should, quote, diversify. This term is thrown around so loosely in the financial world. People think that having different mutual funds means they are diversified. Others think they have to have stocks in each one of the different major sectors. Others think they need real estate or real property. Diversification. When I was an institutional investment advisor, we would occasionally write memos to our institutional clients, to our college foundations, private foundations, endowments, etc. And these a lot of these memos were just really to calm worries. It'd be the leading story that was driving markets, or there was a level of fear. And so we would kind of address what was going on. And all memos need a conclusion. And invariably, the conclusion to our memo was diversify. That was the message. If you're diversified, you'll be able to ride out the storm. And diversification has very much become, it is, as Adam pointed out, just sort of tossed around, thrown around loosely. It's become a platitude, almost a cliche, and rarely do we step back and say, am I really diversified? What does diversification mean? And Adam looked at some, has certainly listened to the old episodes, and it sounds like I didn't really address what it means to diversify. Episode 20 talked about how to allocate your assets. Episode 21, investing without a map, were both episodes on asset allocation and particularly the flaws with modern portfolio theory and how to invest without a map, but I didn't really address diversification. So we want to address it here. Hopefully you'll find it interesting. And traditionally, though, diversification from in modern portfolio theory was, and we talked about this, you have these models. The models have an expected return for a particular asset category, say U.S. stocks. It has an expected volatility risk. To what extent is those stocks supposed to go up or expected to go up or down? But then you have this concept of correlation. How does one asset category move their returns, move in tandem with another? Are international stocks, they tend to go up just like U.S. stocks at the same time. Maybe not as far, not as high, but there's this idea of correlation. And traditionally with modern portfolio theory, diversification meant you optimize a portfolio for the, you would minimize risk or volatility for an expected level of return. And you can go back to episode 20 and re-listen to that. So I won't dwell on it here, but that concept of correlation is a key aspect. And the idea is if you put uncorrelated assets together, statistically, you'll be diversified. The flaw with that model is, and a flaw with asset allocation models, it assumes these correlations between one asset type and another are static. And the reality is they shift depending on the market environment. This became perfectly clear in 2008 when many asset types that were thought to be uncorrelated or only partially correlated were actually perfectly correlated during that downtrend. They all fell like a rock and exposing investors to large losses. And so I tend to not use sort of these dubious statistical models to figure out whether my portfolio is diversified. And instead, I use more of a qualitative framework for deciding to what extent am I diversified or how to diversify it. And this qualitative framework, it's not rocket science, and it's what many hedge fund managers use, many private capital managers use, many investors, top-tier investors use. Maybe not these exact three questions that I'm using, but the concept. And the reality is I learned a lot of these concepts from hedge fund managers. Here's the questions. Question one, in terms of diversification, what is the primary driver of the potential return for an investment? Investments returns have primary drivers, something that is the primary thing that's impacting what the return will be. And I'll give some examples here in a few minutes. The second question first, what can I do to minimize the likelihood of losing money on this investment? And question three is the potential upside of this investment significantly higher than its potential downside? So those are the three questions that we want to explore more deeply. And I'll give some examples. Now, a perfect portfolio is one in which the investment holdings have different return drivers. In other words, if you have different return drivers, then by definition, you're diversified because you have different things. So perfect portfolio, different return drivers, the downside is limited, and the upside is massive. And the term for that, limited downside, massive upside, is what is known as asymmetrical risk reward. I'll give you a quote. This is a quote from Howard Marks, Oak Tree Capital. They run distressed debt and other private capital strategies. He writes periodic memos, and I'll link to them in the show notes. One of my virtual investing mentors, I have followed him for years and how he invests. I've been out to their firm, our clients, my former clients invested with their firm. Very, very smart investors. Quote, investing requires us to position a portfolio for future developments, but the future isn't knowable. To achieve superior results, an investor must be able, with some regularity, to find asymmetries, instances when the upside potential exceeds the downside risk. And that's what successful investing is. Asymmetrical risk reward. The potential upside perhaps is 5-1 compared to the downside. And having different return drivers. And why do we invest this way? Because, as Howard Marks says, the future isn't knowable. We cannot predict the future, what's going to happen. And so we have to try to structure portfolios with different return drivers. Now, let me give you an example of a particular investment. When I, back about 10 years ago at my old firm, I was drafted, volunteered to co-lead a direct alternative investments group. So previous to that, we had only invested in what are known as fund-to-funds. So if we invested in private equity, such as venture capital leveraged buyout funds, we would invest in, we would research managers, but they were allocating to the underlying limited partnerships. And we wanted to invest directly in limited partnerships for our clients. And so I was going to co-head this group. We were hiring additional analysts, but given we were short-staffed, I became the energy timber analyst, sort of real assets with the exception of real estate. And real assets doesn't typically include real estate. So real assets would be energy and timber. And I didn't know a whole lot about either one. And one way to learn to invest is I like to focus on asset classes. And so I took a deep dive into energy and timber. And I want to talk about timber today and apply these three questions. What is the primary driver of timber? If you own a tree farm, and there are tree farms out there, what is the primary driver of returns? Well, having toured these tree farms once by helicopter in Oregon, you quickly learn as you meet with timber investment management organizations called TIMOs, is the primary driver of timber returns is the fact that trees grow. And you can, if you have a long enough holding period, and you buy young trees, so you buy a tree stand that's 2 or 3 years old, just been planted, and you're going to hold it for 25 years, it is virtually impossible to lose money on that investment. The downside risk is limited. Why? Because the primary driver return is the fact that those trees are going to grow. Now, first thing people think of when you think of trees, well, what if they burn down? That's an extreme event. And so you don't want to just buy one plot of tree. You buy, and institutions do that, you buy several plots of trees. Now, they don't typically insure. You would think, well, go get fire insurance. But most TIMOs don't. It's just not cost effective to insure for fire or disease, because typically you can plant in such a way that you're not going to get totally wiped out. And you try and tree farms in very arid areas isn't terribly effective either, because if you're in a high mountain desert running a tree farm where forest fires are a potential risk, that means it doesn't rain very much, which means the trees don't grow very fast, which means your capital, your investment, isn't increasing in value very quickly. But the primary driver of trees or timber as investment is the growth of the trees. It's not necessarily the price of wood, because if wood prices are depressed, you don't have to sell. You can, the timber managers call it storing the value on the stump, where you don't have to go out and sell. You can store the value as the tree will continue to grow. Your investment will continue to appreciate as time passes. That's an example of a return driver, growing trees. Eventually you will harvest them, sell them for wood, but it's a great independent investment stream, different return driver than anything else. Now consider a stock portfolio. US stocks, European stocks, Asian stocks. What is the primary driver of stock returns? It's corporate earnings growth, which is primarily driven by the growth of the economy. And if you own a diversified portfolio of stocks, that is the primary return driver. And that's why most investors aren't really diversified. They might think they're diversified if they do the whole correlation analysis and you've minimized your return or you maximize your return for a given level of risk. But in reality, because the primary return driver is the growth of the economy, that's just not diversification. You need investments with different return drivers. Having bonds in your portfolio, the primary return driver of fixed income is the income component, the fact that bonds pay interest. And in fact, the bonds actually, and if the economy is slowing, interest rates tend to fall, the value of those bonds go up. And so that's a natural diversifier to stocks.
Let me pause here to share some words from this week's sponsors.
We have a brand new sponsor to our show. It's Yahoo Finance. Yahoo's been around for decades. My first email outside of work was a Yahoo email address. But the financial side, I've used on occasion primarily to get data for dividend histories for particular funds or ETFs. But I was pleasantly surprised to get back on Yahoo Finance to see how it's evolved over the years. Now it's really a financial dashboard where you can get an understanding of what's going on with the markets. There are relevant articles from Bloomberg, Reuters, the Associated Press, and the Yahoo Finance team. You can look at the economic events calendar and see which data series are being released that day and what the consensus is. You can see the pulse of the markets at any time by going to Yahoo Finance. In addition, you could see all of your investments and retirement accounts in one place with Yahoo Finance. You get a consolidated view of multiple accounts. Yahoo Finance serves as a financial hub for your retirement accounts, but also comprehensive financial news and analysis. You need to check out Yahoo Finance, particularly if you haven't been there in a while. Check it out at yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com. If you've been using Mint to manage your finances, you know they shut down several months ago. Well, let me tell you about the budgeting solution, the financial tracking solution I've been using for the past number of months. It's Monarch Money. Monarch Money is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. You can create custom budgets like I've done. You can set goals, collaborate with your partner. And now you can get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/David. What I like about Monarch is the ability to customize what I want to see. I have custom budget categories, and then I can go on to the dashboard and see where I'm above trend on some of my spending. I especially like that Monarch will never sell your data to third parties or show you ads. After trying Monarch myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/David. That's monarchmoney.com/David for your extended 30-day free trial.
What's interesting about hedge funds and private capital managers is they seek out return drivers that are completely differentiated from anything else. And let me give you a couple examples. And I first realized this back, I think it was probably 2000, 2001, I met with Bill Ackman, hedge fund manager. He runs Pershing Square Capital Management now. This was his former firm called Gotham Partners. In fact, there was a recent profile in the New Yorker on Bill Ackman, and I'll include it in the show notes. But I was meeting with him, and he described an investment in their portfolio that they had gotten very, very cheap, and their return driver was the potential outcome or the eventual outcome of a lawsuit. And I don't remember the specifics of it, but what I remember is, wow, he's got an investment where the return driver is whether they win a lawsuit or not, which would be a diversifier because if you got it cheap enough. And if you got it so cheap that if they lost, there was limited downside, but if they won, there was massive upside, and that's how this investment was. And the driver of the return was the outcome of a lawsuit. That's a great diversifier. Another example is, we go back to Howard Marks, Oak Tree Capital, that does distressed debt. What's the return driver of distressed debt? Well, distressed debt, first off, you're buying notes or bonds, could be private notes, that are in default or very, very near default. So they're selling for 20 cents on the dollar, 30 cents on the dollar. The return driver, in some extent, what happens then is they form a credit committee and there's a workout. And ultimately, the return driver is just time, in the sense that the vast majority of the time, there is a settlement. And it's just a question of how long is that settlement going to take. So if you're buying distressed debt at 20 cents, you have a seat at the table on the creditor committee, so you have a large amount of stake, then you're there in negotiations. And it's just a negotiation workout process, has to be approved by the bankruptcy judge. But it's a return stream that is driven by a defined process that works out over time. And that's what drives return of distressed debt. It doesn't have to do with the economic growth. It doesn't have to do, it's very much just time to work out as part of a creditor committee. Here's another example of a distinct return driver. In 2010, I met with a hedge fund in New York, and I forget the name of it, but they had actually formed their own mortgage servicing company. If you recall, during the housing bust, many banks had a lot of underperforming mortgage where the residents that owned the houses hadn't paid in a very long time. And this hedge fund negotiated with its banks to buy this mortgage paper very, very cheaply. And then they started, the hedge fund, their own mortgage servicing subsidiary and started working with these homeowners. They had bought the paper so cheap that they could actually write down the value of the mortgage, lower the payment, and keep the homeowners in their home. And their whole model was to keep them in their home. And eventually, once they were able to restructure the paper, resell it, and that was their strategy. But the return driver was completely, again, different from the market. It was their ability to restructure this paper, but they created their desire to create an independent return stream, independent from anything else. They'd started their own mortgage company. And that's really a key to diversification, is to try to identify investments. First off, every investment you need to understand before you go and invest, what is it that's driving the return? And what's the potential upside? And what's the potential downside? And is there an asymmetrical risk reward? Much greater upside versus downside. Ray Dalio, who runs the fund Bridgewater, has built a whole strategy around this called the all-weather portfolio, where in their case, it's going back to this idea that most investors have too much exposure to the stock market or one primary driver return, economic growth. He's created a portfolio where they've actually levered up the fixed income. It's a risk parity portfolio, so fixed income returns are lower typically than stocks, but if you go out on margin and buy fixed income, you can get a expected volatility similar to stocks, but the return driver is very different. There's a book coming out in this month by Tony Robbins, and I didn't know very much about Tony Robbins. I just didn't follow him. I know he did infomercials. It seems like he did a lot of consulting. But he hasn't written a book in 20 years. He's written a 700 or 650-page book. It's called Money, Master the Game. He recently was interviewed by Tim Ferriss on Tim Ferriss's podcast. And what's interesting about this book is Tony Robbins interviewed some of the top investors, individuals like Paul Tudor Jones, Ray Dalio that I mentioned, Jack Bogle. And he reiterate in this podcast, and I assume it's in his book, some of the takeaways that he's learned from these top investors. And they very much echo these three questions that I'm talking about that you should think about anytime you do an investment. He said these top-tier investors are obsessed with not losing money. The level of obsession that is mind-boggling is what he said. Their first focus whenever they do investment is, how do I not lose money? That's the first focus. Second, they're obsessed with asymmetrical risk reward. Least amount of risk for maximum amount of the upside, just as we echoed. And third, they absolutely know beyond a shadow of doubt that they're going to be wrong. And so investing involves making a mistake. But with an investment, if you have minimized a potential downside and your upside is massive, or you have an asymmetrical risk reward, then you can actually make a lot of mistakes and still be profitable. And that's the concept. Now, I recognize that most of us can't invest in distressed debt. We can't go out and buy a timber farm. We're sort of stuck with mostly publicly traded asset categories. That's one reason if you've looked at investing on a map, you see I have a large percent of my portfolio in bonds and to some extent in cash, because I don't want to have a high percentage of the return driver be stocks where I'm exposed to simply the growth economy. I want to diversify as much as possible. One thing I've done, and this is something that smaller investors can do, is I have bought private real estate. I bought a house. We bought a house in May. It was through an estate sale. I sat for many years on our local planning and zoning board, so I know the zoning of our town, and it's a block from the university in a special zone called Podesta, the PED zone, I think, where you can do more concentrated investing. I bought it for $170,000. I've never really bought private real estate before other than my farm. But I knew the process of getting the permits and what it would take to take this house and split it into a triplex. At least I thought I did. I knew the permitting process. Now, we've made a lot of mistakes. The contractor had didn't realize we needed this in the final inspection, that we actually needed three furnaces and the windows weren't right. And we've had delay after delay after delay. It's been 6 months. We still don't have renters in. Yet, it's a great diversifier ultimately because, one, I know the downside is limited because I know because of the zone it's in that I bought it for essentially cheaper than the value of the land. But there was a house on it. So I can afford to put money in it. There's a house on it to put in the triplex, but I have a floor, the value of the land, which is actually much higher than my purchase price when somebody comes along and wants to build a five-story apartment building because it's a block and a half from the university. The primary driver of returns, once I have renters in, is the growth of the university, and it's the rental income. That's why private real estate's a great investment because it's not necessarily tied. It's hyper-local. You get it in the right spot. It's not tied to necessarily what's going on Wall Street, et cetera. So that's an example of a diversifier that many investors can pursue. And that's one reason why a lot of investors do that, because it is an independent return stream separate completely from the growth of the economy, from anything else. And it's a great investment. But the key is obviously what you pay for it and to buy at as cheaply as you can. And real estate in my town is pretty pricey. And so it wasn't until this thing came along that we actually felt like we had an opportunity. So in summary, to be diversified means finding investments where the return drivers are independent, where you understand what the potential downside is and do everything you can to minimize the risk of loss, and where the potential reward is greater, hopefully much greater, than the downside. Those are hard to find. Investing is hard. But the key is don't feel overly confident that you're diversified because you followed modern portfolio theory. Understand what you own and how it behaves and what drives the returns. So that is episode 30. You can get show notes for this episode at moneyfortherestofus.net. That's also where you can sign up for my insider's guide, where I'll email you weekly the show notes, mention things that I forgot to put in the podcast or in the episode, answer listener questions. That's at moneyfortherestofus.net, the insider's guide. It's also where show notes are. Any questions, email me, please, jd@jdavidstein.com. Everything I've shared with you in this episode is for general education only. I've not considered your specific risk profile. I've not provided investment advice, simply general education on money, investing, and the economy. Next week, episode 31.